Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Karen Tongson jokes that she's been listening to the music of Karen and Richard Carpenter since she was in utero in her native Philippines. Her mother even named her after Karen Carpenter. Tongson says that the Carpenters may have even been more popular there than they were here. She explains why in her book, Why Karen Carpenter Matters. Part memoir, part biography, the book dives into Carpenter's legacy and how it isn't just limited to her music.
She matters in so many different ways for so many people. What I wanted really to focus on in my book was why she mattered to people who might be unexpected in her realm of fandoms, you know, or the amongst the fans who might be expected to like her music. The Carpenters are so often associated with a particular kind of middle American, 70s, kind of wholesome and kind of antithetical to the counterculture vibe. To me, I think that one of the things that I take for granted is that the Carpenters, Karen Carpenter herself, both are so beloved by the Filipino people and by people of color and LGBT people, and that sort of fan base is not as readily thought of in relationship to the Carpenters. So I wanted to explore why she mattered to people who have identities that seem at odds with some of the things the Carpenters sang about.
Yeah, and I want to ask you why Karen Carpenter matters to you personally. Your musician parents named you after her, but there's more to it than that, isn't there?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot more to that. So my parents were musicians. My mom and bio dad met as part of a large group called the Circus Band, who performed in Manila, known for original Filipino music in the 1970s. And my mom named me after Karen in part because her own voice was often compared to Karen Carpenter's because she too had a low alto voice. And so in some strange way, it was almost like naming me after her, but mediated through this famous figure. So it wasn't quite a direct link just to her name, but to something that said something about my mom.
Can you take me back to the very first time you heard the Carpenters?
I always say when people ask me this question that I can't really pinpoint it because I'm assuming I listened to the Carpenters in utero. My parents were listening to the music. I was born in 1973 at the height of the Carpenters' fame, really when they were breaking out, making gold record, platinum singles, etc. And so I feel like I never knew a time that the Carpenters were not a part of my sonic landscape.
The first Carpenters hit that was written by Richard Carpenter and his songwriting partner John Bettis was a song called Goodbye to Love, which was released in 1972. You say that it's one of their most innovative original songs. What's so innovative about it?
When we listen to it now with 2020 hearing, that's kind of fun to say.
Yeah, that's fun to hear you say.
Well, listening to it many decades after something called the power ballad has basically become a standard sound in popular music, it doesn't sound that remarkable. But if you think back to 1972 and think back to, again, the sound the Carpenters were associated with, which was a certain kind of mainstream balladry, middle-of-the-road balladry. And part of what made it so innovative was that it was really one of the first hit singles to include a sawtoothed guitar solo, like basically shredding up the middle of a song that's otherwise quite placid and gentle. For those of us who've listened to Heart and Journey and everybody else basically from the 80s, we're trained to hear that as something that's always existed, but that's one of the first songs, if not the first song, to create that contrast and to provide that power ballad sound we all love.
You immigrated to the U.S. in the early 1980s, and it was around 1984 that you played that song, Goodbye to Love, for a couple of your next-door neighbors. Can you tell me about this?
I thought that given how much a song like Goodbye to Love sounded like some of the pop ballads of the 80s, especially Journey, who I already mentioned, especially something like Open Arms, right?
Right.
I thought that it would be amenable to the, you know, kids next door. We were like basically, I don't know, pre-adolescence or adolescence. And during a long listening session of listening to Journey and a bunch of other folks, I decided to play Goodbye to Love because I thought it was very much in keeping with that sound. And people were just like, the boys next door were like, what is this? Who are you? This is so cornball. Part of me was so confused, again, because of the sonic similarities, you know, between a ballad with a delicate piano and other instruments and then a big guitar solo. So, yeah, that was one of my first times of really acknowledging to myself that my tastes in music, the styles that I felt attached to, might be out of step with what the young folks of my new place that I was living in were into.
You write that although Karen Carpenter was supposed to be your gateway to a whole new world, she actually ended up being the anchor to your old world. Can you explain that?
The Carpenters, because of their ubiquity on Filipino radio, in Filipino popular music, on television, I just assumed that they were as enduring in the kind of soundscapes of Southern California in the 1980s. And as we just discussed, I found out I was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when I realized I was wrong, part of what happened is I realized how profoundly the Carpenters, to me, sounded like the Philippines and not the United States, that how it reminded me of home, of my family, of my earliest days, hearing everyone sing their music and knowing that I was named after Karen Carpenter. So it was a connection to that past in the Philippines, and less so a kind of gateway to the America that the Carpenters always sang about.
Mm. Why do you think that that's the case?
I think that one of the kind of historical reasons to think about why the Carpenters were popular in the Philippines is that Armed Forces Radio had a certain kind of playlist that it stuck to. And it was often things that were middle-of-the-road ballads, you know, kind of adult contemporary-ish songs, nothing too raucous. The whole movie Good Morning Vietnam is about that conflict, right?
Right.
And, you know, given that the U.S. had its naval bases and its influence and enduring influence in the Philippines, I think that's one of the reasons why music like the Carpenters and the Carpenters themselves were in such deep circulation in the 70s and during that particular era. That said, I think it also, you know, the Carpenters, so much of their music is about singing along and singing songs together. And the Philippines has a really deep and profound public singing culture.
Mm.
They just became standards because they were songs we could sing along to. Karen's alto voice wasn't too high. And
yeah.
Even those of us who didn't have good voices could manage to match pitch and like share the sentiment.
I'm on the top of the world looking down on creation, and the only explanation I can find is the love that I've found ever since you've been around. Your love's put me at the top of the world.
So I do think that those things combined, that bit of feel and that bit of history, combined to create that ubiquity.
Mm. What was the relationship between Karen and her brother Richard like?
I think that they were extremely close. I think that he was her older brother and she sort of was his sidekick. Like that was kind of their vibe and that's how they were growing up. And I think that Richard's talents were very much fostered by the family. And he was always seen as the kind of primary musician. And Karen sort of fell into singing, fell into playing the drums, in part because she was supporting her brother. And so I think that it led to a different dynamic later on when Karen began to emerge as the person who people paid attention to.
Mm. Yeah, I was surprised to learn how the Carpenter's mother, Agnes, totally favored Richard and basically ignored Karen. How did this favoritism affect her?
I mean, there's so many different speculations about that, that it's one of the reasons that Karen suffered from anorexia at various points in her life and eventually killed her. But I like to think a little bit differently about that, that it was more than just, you know, wanting love for mom. There's, again, several other biographies and other news pieces sort of focus on that. But I think that it was a whole kind of ecosystem that that really pushed Karen Carpenter to not feel the greatest about herself and her body and her appearance. And there are ways in which I think she just sort of wanted to disappear from certain registers of attention. And that didn't really have to do with whether or not her mom had a preference for her older brother.
Mm. You say that straight as she seemed, in all senses of the word, Karen was the original coordinate for your queerness. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Karen Carpenter just stood out as somebody who didn't quite fit in. And I think that a lot of her music sang of unrequited love. A lot of her music focused on not being sure there would be anybody there to love you.
When there's no
And I think that that's the kind of sentiment and feeling that a lot of young LGBT people have, that as a person who has all this love to give and the capacity to love, there is a fear that you'll never find anyone, at least back then. I think that it might be different now, but mm-hmm. that you might never find anyone who would love you back. And I think that she gave voice to that, in many respects, a torch song singer. And that torchiness and its kind of long association with LGBT cultures is one of the reasons I find Karen Carpenter has such resonance in LGBT communities.
Yeah. Has writing this book changed the way you experience her music?
I think so. I think that I listen differently. I mean, I think that in a way it moved music that had always been in a kind of background, that had always been kind of ambiently present, as I said, almost from in utero to now. Mm-hmm. And it made me really listen more carefully to what it was, what it is that lingers with me and that feels important. And it made me hear certain songs anew and really appreciate the kind of skill level there in her voice, and also in what the Carpenters did as a band, as musicians.
Mm. Can you give an example of one of the certain songs?
Yeah, I think that on the Close to You album, their first really big breakout record, there's a song called Maybe It's You. And I'd never thought about that song before, and I never really sort of paused to think about how there's a certain level of irony and cruelty to it, and that also just the richness, again, of the harmonies. It's a minor song in the Carpenters' canon, but, you know, that's, like, when I hear it now, it's just bursting with so much angst, possibility, emotion, and it's become my new favorite in the course of listening again for this project.
Rising on the shore, the ocean here walks along the waves of
Karen Carpenter died on February 4th, 1983. She was only 32. You were still young when she passed. Can you take me back to how you found out?
I was still 9 years old. My family and I were in the middle of making our preparations to leave the Philippines and move to Riverside, California, where my stepdad grew up. So his mother became ill, and so we had to kind of leave the Philippines abruptly and come and help take care of her in Riverside. And we were at a travel agency in the kind of Manila's Chinatown district, Little Ongpin. And I just remember seeing on the front page of the newspaper, Filipino newspaper, that Karen Carpenter dies, you know, at 32.
Wow.
And I remember it really struck me because, you know, when the person who you're named after dies, especially when they die young, you mm-hmm. feel like, I don't know, that somehow that is related to you and your experience, et cetera, in some way. And so I remember it really, as I say in the book, it really inaugurated my fear of mortality.
What is Karen Carpenter's legacy?
I think that she really carved out a place for female vocalists. She's seen as one of the great voices of all time. And I think that that is just undeniable. There is something, you know, you can't train that. It's something that she just remarkably had as a gift that she was born with. At the same time, you know, I think that when we think about some of the other singers who we know for their voice and the quality of that voice who've come since Karen Carpenter, we can see that legacy. We can see that they're also misfits in their own way. I'm thinking of people who've spoken openly about emulating Karen Carpenter, like Katie Lang, for example.
Yes.
And so I do think that, you know, she has a much broader, richer afterlife. I think that in her time, she was very much kind of perceived to exist within a very hermetically sealed world and environment, in a kind of wholesome one. And I think that since she passed, and since people learned more about her suffering in various ways, that we've come to understand she had a much more complex, a richer, sadder, and sometimes also different life than we anticipated.
Karen Tongson, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
We're lost in this masquerade.
Karen Tongson is the author of Why Karen Carpenter Matters. Find out more about Karen and Karen Carpenter at WPR.org/beta.
I think it's up there with I Love Lucy, Cheers, and Seinfeld. Is sort of a timeless show that'll be funny now and even 50 years.
Author Andy Green joins us to talk about the staying power of The Office. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.